So what I'd like to do today is talk about the book and also shed some light for the listeners as to, you mentioned up front that the book is third, it's a trilogy, the three books. So
yeah.
I would like you to touch on that too. If I'm just listening to you for the first time and I have this book, do I want to read them in order? Does it matter? So I'd like you to talk about that and then talk about the value creation pyramid or whatever you're calling that, because that's really interesting to me. I would have never thought to put service as its own level.
Yeah. Unless it's missing.
That was an aha for me, because it's usually product and service we lump together. And I really saw when I read that piece of it, how we can differentiate ourselves on service even. For example, one of my clients has a 97% renewal rate on their software.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. They do an amazing piece of software though. So it makes sense. They're literally saving lives with their software. So it's amazing to see it in action, but also there's a loyalty there that I know is an outlier for them. You know, it's something that they can really talk about and they probably don't.
Yeah.
So I circled that. Like, wait a minute.
That's important. I mean, if it's a, and this is the thing, and I don't know if you're recording or not, but I will mention it.
Yes, I'm recording.
I think that what happens to sales organizations is they don't realize that the fact that their support and their service and the experience is such a differentiator that it creates a level of value that for the client ends up being something that's important to retention. So a lot of people, when they see this framework, are like, okay, so everything is level four. Well, level four transcends and includes all the other levels. So you're like, well, I'm super strategic, but my product sucks, our service is terrible, and it doesn't really get you the job done in the first place. Well, okay, really good that you're strategic, but I need all of the levels. And I think people misunderstand the way that we start a conversation and the way that we create the maximum value is to get to strategic first. So we just change the order in which you come at this problem. Mm-hmm. But you still need level one and level two and level three. You need all of the levels. And it's that combination together when you recognize what part of it's making up the ability for you to generate that strategic outcome. That's where you end up really, really over-indexing on results, because you now have something worth a serious conversation when it comes to leaving somebody you've been working with for, you know, a decade or more, which is a hard problem.
It is. It is. And I think more and more, this book really spoke to me on so many different levels. The opener, maybe it was Jeb who talked about it, but how we are forgetting how to sell. I mean, we're not even at the point where we are comfortable having these types of conversations. We hide behind email, we hide behind social to get these conversations started and to create an opening that way. And I love that realization in the book where you talk about that. And it's like, yeah, this is what we're dealing with as coaches, consultants, working it with companies, is that we've forgotten how to have a sales conversation, a meaningful sales conversation.
I think that's right. And I do think that we've gotten, I mean, this is in one book back. So in The Lost Art of Closing, I didn't write this, but the publisher did. They wrote Always Be Closing, Glengarry Glenn Ross, you know, 1988 or whatever. And then it was Never Be Closing, you know, a sales book, 20, whatever year that was, 15 or something like that. And and I think what happens to humans generally is that you start off with this idea of, oh, wait, always be closing is bad. So what's the opposite of that? Never be closing. Okay, so if always be closing is bad, then never be closing has to be the right answer. Mm-hmm. No, that's not the right answer. And sort of this idea of, well, if asking for commitments, you know, if closing is bad, then asking for commitments is bad. Let the buyer tell you what to do. And we get confused by this. If interrupting people is bad, then what must be the right thing to do is to just wait for people to reach out to you. So you go from being a hunter, which, you know, people don't like that word because of the aggressiveness of the connotation, but it's the word that we've traditionally used as hunters and farmers. Mm-hmm. Instead, they're like, well, no, I'm a fisherman now, or I'm a trapper. I just lay lines out and then I go check to see if anybody touched anything. But the passivity, so you go from this is outbound. It is proactive to this is responsive and reactive and waiting. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of what I've written over the course of three books is trying to find this point to explain to people. It's not always be closing. If closing means that you skip the process and don't help somebody make a good decision because you're in too big of a hurry. And it's definitely not never be closing because there's all these commitments that people have to make. And we've lost that part. And we don't even talk about competition anymore. I mean, it's not mm-hmm. something that we talk about, but it's part of the game that we play. And I wrote a post on Forbes about a red ocean strategy. And I start the book talking about the blue ocean strategy that the Harvard professors wrote about. Be so different and so unique that you have no competition. Right. Well, how do you go to the 99.6% of the population that doesn't have that advantage? Mm-hmm. What are they supposed to do? They have to call on their competitors' customers, and their competitors are calling on theirs. And we need to address it. And because you read the book, you know there's nothing about attacking your competitor. That's not how you win. And focusing on your competitor, and I keep teasing people with this idea, go to your competitor and say, both compete in the same industry, we're both professional, I'd like to ask you to stop using your irrational pricing scheme and stop saying bad things about me behind my back. Go try that and see if they're going to say, you know what, I never really thought of it that way. Now that you said that, I'm going to price exactly the same as you so we can have a fair contest. It's not real. And we live in a red ocean, and you have to have some amount of competitiveness. And I said this in the book, so you know this. I mean, you're not a mafia don or a warlord. You're not out to mm-hmm. destroy people, but you are competing in this great upward spiral of advance in our economy, and in the value that people create for their customer comes from that competition that causes, I beat Mary Lou, and then she looks at what I do and she goes, wait a second, I need to up the game here to do even better than he's doing. And so the customer and the economy and everybody benefits from that, even if you don't benefit from it in the short term.
Right. You know, as I was looking at the book, I love the fact that we can get online books now because I can see what other people highlight versus what interests me. One of the things that was highlighted early on in the book, I don't remember how many, but it talked about, is when you talked about this whole concept of very little of what leads to successfully taking your competitors' clients has anything to do with the competitors themselves, as we just talked about. Instead, you said, you will win those clients by creating greater value than they do.
Right. I mean, that's a mindset shift for a lot of salespeople. They think it's my product, or mm-hmm. it's my company, or it's something external to me. But the real test is who wins is the salesperson that comes in and creates compelling differentiated value, where somebody goes, wait, that's the smartest person. This is the best idea we've heard. This is the right answer for us. This person gets me. And there's a lot of different ways to create value for people. And understanding how to help a buyer make a good decision was in The Lost Art of Closing, which is why these books came out in that order. Mm-hmm. The first book was The Only Sales Guide, an unfortunate title when you have two more books following very fast on the tail of that one. But that book was first Be Somebody Worth Buying From. And it's a competency model where there's mindset and skill set. That comes first because if you're somebody that's worth doing business with in the first place, that solves a big part of your challenge in sales. So get that part right. Yeah. And then learn how to control the process and learn how to serve the buyer by making sure they do the things they need to do to really get what they want. That's the second book. And the reason I did them in this order is because when you get to this third book, it's a little bit of a step up, even though I think each book was a step up from the one in front of it. But it's a step up in your responsibility to say, I'm not competing against my competitor who's $8 billion to my $100 million company. I'm competing against the salesperson that's sitting there competing for this business or who owns the business now. And when you get that understanding, you understand that you're the value proposition. So you have to go in and do the work to create a preference to work with you instead of everyone else. And that can be a real mindset shift for people.
That is an incredible mind shift, especially I know people are listening thinking, you know, we've heard this term, create greater value, create more value, create better value. a lot of times we don't even know where to begin. Is there a recipe for that? But what you're saying is, yes, there's a tactical way to do it, but you have to change your mindset in that it's not the company creating the value. It's you as the person creating value. It's your personal value proposition, what you're bringing to the table. That's a whole different way to look at this and try to get your arms around, where do I begin?
Well, the way that I think about the beginning, and we've talked about the four levels of value. So level one is the value of your product or service. Level two is the value of experience, which is your services, your support, how easy you are to do business with, what that interaction feels like for the people that buy what it is you sell. Level three is the tangible result you produce. So if you say, well, we're a printing company, so we print things and we ship them from here to here. Okay, mm-hmm. Good. Do they make it from here to there? Yeah, they do. Okay, good. So that's the outcome that people need. You can print it. You can get it to them. But if the reason that you sent something by mail in the first place was because you were helping them acquire new clients, then the strategic outcome is what you send going to cause somebody to sign up with you? And that's the real thing. So you look at that and you say, what's the strategic outcome? Well, they want greater market share, or they're trying to penetrate a new territory, or they're trying to retain their existing customers and get them to buy more. That's the strategic outcome that they're really working on. And what we've done historically is we've come in from the left. Mm-hmm. And when I say that, what I mean is if you're looking at a PowerPoint deck, level one would be all the way over on your left. And we're like, well, let me tell you about my company. Let me tell you about the services we offer. Let me tell you a little bit about me. Let me tell you about the kind of clients we're working with. And then I'll ask you some questions so I can learn a little bit more about you. And when people hear that now, they're like, well, listen, I'm busy washing my hair that day. I'm sorry, I don't have time. You know, they're going to find any excuse they can to get out of that, because when you listen to the value prop is, okay, so you're going to talk about your company. That should be interesting for all of 4 seconds.
Right.
Because we already know who you are and what you do. And then you're going to talk about your solutions, and I'm already buying that solution from someone else, and you're not going to be that incredibly different. And then you're going to talk about you, which should be just the most delightful conversation I've ever imagined happening. And then you're going to ask me what's keeping me up at night. So I know how this story goes, and it ends badly for both of us. I say no to that. But when you start at level four and you say, Mary Lou, I'd like to share with you, you know, the four biggest trends impacting your business over the next 18 to 24 months. Some of the questions we're helping our clients to answer right now, and some of the decisions that we're helping them make, even though there's different choices for different companies. And even if there's not a next step, I'll leave a deck with you with some questions that you can challenge your management team with. And I promise you will make some different decisions after this meeting. What do you look like Thursday for a 20-minute executive briefing? Now, I just tried to pile all the value I could into that because I want somebody to pay attention to why change. And the more strategic you can make that, the more that you create a case for change. And when you start with your product and your company, what you're trying to do is say, I'm not really a value creator. I'm just here as a representative of this company that can create a whole bunch of value. So let me tell you about them. And the pushback that I've gotten on this book and this idea from many salespeople is, yeah, but first I have to prove that I have the ability and the right to have this conversation with them. Well, how do you prove you have to have the right to that conversation? You prove it by having that conversation. So you mm-hmm. just start by being strategic from the beginning. You don't have to lean on your company to say, well, my company's been in business for 85 years and we have 72 locations and you've seen these big logos that we have. Well, okay, great. Hooray for you and your company. It's not why change. It's a proof provider. And if you lean on that for credibility, what you're basically giving up is, I don't really have anything to say myself about any of this, so I'm going to talk about things external to me. But if you have an opinion and you start with level four to say, these are the biggest challenges, these are some of the questions we're helping our clients answer. Now you're starting at a point where there's a conversation to be had. So that's the shift.
It's a big shift. I think that's in the first part of the book where you talk about a lot of that. And you provide worksheets. So for those people thinking, wow, this is kind of woo-woo, I don't even know how I'm going to do this, he has worksheets throughout the entire book that you can download and work on and apply. So it's not sit back and read Anthony's book. It's read and do, read and do.
And all three of the books, every chapter ends with do this now.
Yeah.
And so I mean, important. Why read a book if you're not going to do anything with it? That's right. The same as not reading the book.
Mm-hmm. 100%. So again,
let me just make a disclaimer though. If you want to buy the book and you don't read it, we still are happy with that.
Indeed. Indeed. So to again, summarize this, the levels, there are four levels. And I was actually, as I was telling Anthony at the beginning of the call, that I always lumped product and service together. I didn't think of it as experience and support as its own level. So that was a real big aha moment for me, because we can find so much value. I was sharing that one of my clients is a 90%+ renewal rate on their software. I mean, that's something to celebrate and talk about, and the why behind that. So that was really a great thing for me to see that it's not just product service, it's product service and it's experience and support. And then you go to the business cases and outcomes, which I think most of us get stuck there too.
True.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
We sort of end there, which again, this is new strategic thinking for us, that don't end there, start even higher with the strategic side of things.
And when you think about what you just said, Mary Lou, and you talk about a client who has a 90-something percent retention rate, so automatically I know something else is true. You have clients that have a number far lower than that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so one is doing something about that experience,
right,
that is easier for them to retain people than the other or the many others. And that is part of their recipe for creating level four. And they figured something out to say, look, when we pay better attention to these conversations, we tend to keep them longer. And so maybe the strategic conversation gets you in, but you need all four of the levels. And if they're really good at over-indexing where other people fail, then even that level two can be compelling differentiated value that helps cause somebody to leave their existing supplier and buy from you.
The point is, you've got to do the work. You've got to do the planning. You've got to figure out where your things, what makes you falls in these different levels. This is not a wing it exercise. One of my biggest pet peeves I see is that we're so reliant now on just throwing stuff out there and seeing what sticks, that we've lost the ability to really plan and strategize before we actually execute. It's something we don't assess. We go straight to execution because we have tools now that unfortunately allow us to do that.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that is a mistake for salespeople just generally, the expert on experts is Kay Anders Ericsson. And if you're listening to this, then you know his work as the 10,000 hour rule that Malcolm Gladwell made popular in a book called Outliers. But that's not what he said. He didn't say that 10,000 hours of doing anything actually makes you an expert. What he said was 10,000 hours of deliberate practice makes you an expert. And that's not just doing something for 10,000 hours. And when he describes this, if you read his work, the violinists that he studied, after they did an hour of deliberate practice working on a very difficult passage that they had to do in some piece of music, would take a nap. I mean, it was that draining for them to give themselves over to something so intensely that afterwards they had to have a period of rest. That's not the way most of us plan a sales call. Most of us plan a sales call with something that sounds like this. Mary Lou, I've made 1,000 sales calls, so I'm going to go in and I'm going to find some pain point for them, and then I'm going to get them to agree to have another conversation. Great thinking there. I mean, you did nothing. So there's no deliberate practice. And the way Kay Anders Ericsson expressed this once in Fast Company magazine, I always kept a copy of. He said, I've been walking for 48 years, but I don't feel like I'm getting any better at it. And I think that's the way, it's very possible for people to have 10 years of experience in sales, but to really only have 1 year 10 times. And that's possible for all of us. The more intentional and the more deliberately you think about, what am I trying to do? How am I best going to achieve that? How do I serve this client where they are now? The better the results are. And that's a different exercise than many of us do when it pertains to sales. And I mean, if you're listening to this, I'm not throwing the first stone. I've made thousands of sales calls. I'm also really good at improv. And I'm happy when I haven't prepared, because I get to act and respond to things with an improvisation. But that is not a reason to believe that that's the primary way you should do something. And I'll share just one quick story about that. I was in Toastmasters and I gave a really good speech, made everyone laugh. Everyone was happy. But when you're in Toastmasters, you have somebody who reviews your speech. And mine happened to be PhD Brenda Jones, who after I got done speaking said, "Anthony, that was a really, really good speech. And I can't wait to hear it the second time after you've rehearsed it." And her point was well taken. The fact that you can do that doesn't mean that you delivered the best thing that you could do. But you do have to spend the time to figure out what you do to differentiate and how you compel change, especially if you're in a competitive displacement business where you have to go and work on taking clients from your competitors.
So now let's shift to part two of the book where you talk about building consensus, wiring the building. I love that. I love the title of that section. If we look at our four levels now that our product service, our experience support, business results and outcomes, and strategic partnerships, how does that apply now to the different stakeholders? Do we still need all four with all of our stakeholders, or can we somehow take a portion of things? What is your recommendation there?
Well, you have to serve the person that you're sitting across from. So if you go to an end user and you say, "Listen, I'd like to really talk about the future of your company over the next 18 to 24 months. And I'd like to talk to you about some of the challenges that we're helping other companies with as it pertains to their strategy in this area." You're talking to somebody who's like, "That's great, except I don't have anything to do with that. And I couldn't help you with that even if I wanted to." What do they care about? They care about primarily level one and level two.
And the day in the life.
I need it to work for me. Mm-hmm. Talk to my boss about our long-term strategy. I'm not even sure he knows. That'll be a good conversation for you to have with him. But I need to figure out how to get this thing done now. Okay, so that matches. But when you go to executive leadership, and I'll talk to your audience specifically, and you go, "Listen, Mary Lou, what I want to do is I want to set up an hour and 20 minutes to go through a demo so I can show you the software." You know, if it's me as the person you're calling, I'm like, if I have to know how the software works, we're already done talking, because I'm never going to open the software. I'm never going to open it myself. So you need to talk to somebody who cares about that. Here's what I need to have happen. I need these people to produce better results than they're producing right now. If you can help me help them produce better results, we'll have a great conversation. But if I have to know how the software works, you know, I'm the wrong person to talk to. And we have to match the conversation we're having to the group of people that we're talking with, because what creates a preference for them when you talk to level one people who need level one and two value, and you're talking to them about strategy, you've lost them. And when you talk to level four about level one, you've lost them. And they might have a technical person who cares or something like that, but for the most part, you've got to figure out how to create the right outcome for each group who cares about what. And so in the book, there's a little framework. If they're end users, they care about one and two. If they're what we call ancillary stakeholders, so they're accounting or finance or people who care but they don't use what you sell, but still need your experience to be good, they tend to care about two. Managers tend to care about level three. Can I get the outcomes? Can you make it work? And then leadership tends to care mostly about level four. And they'll leave it to other people to make the decisions about if it's right for levels one, two, and three.
So for those of you who understand that bullseye concept that we talk about in other episodes, where we have the decision makers in the center, and then as we go out, the influence becomes less and less direct. This is a nice alignment for what Anthony's talking about as to how to prepare and plan the way you're going to be building these relationships with these types of users based on his levels. So
why didn't you just send me your list last time we talked? So I didn't have to go to all the trouble to do this work. I could have just taken yours and dropped it in. It would have been really nice.
Because of course, you know, Anthony, you're getting to close. You're the entire pipeline. I am opening the door. That's all I do. So it's a little bit different for us because we tend to love them and leave them, you know, as we pass them off to people that are going to close the business. Not always, but, you know, you're getting a lot more into the nuts and bolts, the long-term relationships, and we're adding value, but it could be very a quick dating environment, and then we go on to the next one.
That doesn't sound very good in the world we live in now when you say it that way.
Indeed. So that's the second section of the book, is really understanding the map, how to plan based on the stakeholders, what is important to them, which means we're not going to be doing demos for everyone just because we want to do a demo. It doesn't work that way. We're looking at the person and what they care about. As we
That's
go into
right.
part three is an interesting part too. There were just so many nuggets in this book. I've got like everything underlined in different colors because we can do that now with the online books and stuff. But let's talk about that. Winning with the intangibles.
This is probably one of the areas, and you know, as we're recording this, my son's at Denison University, and it's in Granville, Ohio, a sleepy little town about 45 minutes out of Columbus. And their president and I met at one of my kids' theater shows, and we were talking, and asked me to have coffee with them. And he asked me, well, how do we, in a liberal arts organization like this, do a better job preparing kids? And they're so focused on skills. But that's not what a liberal arts degree does. And I explained to him, you know, the purpose of the first book, and I've found a way to have woven this through all three books. Is woven the right word? Well, weaved it through? I don't know. One of those two things.
One of them works.
You get the idea. There's a thread that runs through this. But it's the intangibles that actually allow you to win. So when you start thinking about what does a trusted advisor do? Well, they have trust and they offer advice. And I say that and people laugh because it's so simple, but you can't be a trusted advisor if you don't have the level 4 insights so that you can offer people the best advice. And that's really what you're trying to do. And when we say things like, I want to be consultative, what most of us mean when we say that is, I don't want to be high pressure. I don't want to be a hard sell, and I want to ask really good questions. Well, that's not what the word consultative means. Consultative means you tell them how to run their business. That's what you do. When you're consulting with someone, you're telling them, these are the best decisions for you to make to get a better result in your business. And so consultative comes to give that advice. And the challenge for most of us is we don't work on the intangibles. And there's even, you know, in one of the chapters at the end of the book, I mean, it's very helpful to have a sense of humor and levity. It's very, very helpful to be thoughtful and follow up and care about people. And those kinds of things over-index on preference, even though we don't talk about them. We're so transactional right now. And I think one thing that technology has done that's probably hurt sales organizations more than anything else is that you have an example of Amazon.com, where Bezos has 300 salespeople for AWS, and that's all they have. They don't have any salespeople. And he thinks they shouldn't have any salespeople at all. That's his vision. Mm-hmm. And so you have a whole bunch of people trying to optimize everything to the point that they can eliminate all of the friction that comes with human interactions, and someone should just be able to order what they want and buy. But that's not the world that we live in. That's one view of the world that we live in, that we've gone super transactional. And for things that you don't care about, you're going to be more and more transactional over time. I'm sitting in a loft into stock this place up with the stuff I needed to be able to do work. I reached out to Amazon. I had them bring water and coffee and all kinds of other stuff, and that's easy. But when you're making a decision where the future of your company depends on that decision, you want somebody that you have a deep relationship with, that knows your business, that has situational knowledge. And in one chapter, we talk about the 52% SME. You maybe don't have to be the SME, but you better be half or better of a SME, because you have to be able to talk about these things in a way that allows you to have somebody make the decision, I prefer to work with you instead of someone else. And that's really where the bar is set right now, whether we like it or not. So I will tell you the second choice, super transactional, certainly a choice, but for most of us, the right choice is super relational. How do I become high trust, high caring, high value, where people prefer to work with me? And that's the part where you have to do some work on you.
Exactly. For those of you who are wondering what the heck is SME, it's subject matter expert. When I first saw that term too a long time ago, I'm like, what the heck are they talking
about?
What's a SME? What does that mean? So we're pretty much out of time, Anthony, but I want to make sure that the listeners know the books. The first one is The Only Sales Guide You'll Ever Need.
Except for the next two,
which is The Lost Art of Closing. Great book. And that came out just last year, right?
2017, yeah.
2017. And August. Then this book, Eat Their Lunch. They are great books. It's a trilogy. So if you are inclined and you're really wanting to make a difference in the way that you work and the results you're going to get, I recommend all three. And I think it's best you do them in order, but Anthony can tell you what he suggests regarding that. But
doing them in order is great. But what I sent to somebody who asked me that yesterday on LinkedIn is I said, read the first two chapters of Eat Their Lunch, and then read The Lost Art of Closing, and then read the first book. But I kind of wanted to just give them a jump start on level four, because once you sort of get that into your mind, it infects the way that you think about everything. You're realizing, like, wait, I need to start way, way higher than I am. And that tends to help them a lot.
That, and you also need to be nimble with, it's not all level four conversations.
Right.
I think that's
right.
A big part of this, especially since we are talking and more people are getting involved in decisions. And we need to switch gears when we sense that we're talking to a level two or level three. We don't have the same story that we tell to everyone in the prospects company. It just doesn't work.
That is right. I mean, serve the person in front of you.
Yes. Yes. Anthony, always a pleasure. And
thank you so much.
I really thank you so much for starting my new year off. This is my first interview of the year. So glad it was
awesome.
You.
Awesome. Me too. Thank you.
And how is the best way for people who want to follow you, learn more from you, apply what you're teaching? What's the best way we can reach out to you?
My is thesalesblog.com. And I publish there every day. There's a newsletter. That's probably the very best way for people to connect.
Okay. I'll make sure I put that in the show notes for everyone. Anthony, again, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Mary, though.